UFOs? Are they aliens? Government secret projects? The imaginings of disturbed individuals? Or just outright hoaxes? We're here to find out. Welcome to Jim Harold's UFO Encounters. Welcome to UFO Encounters. I am Jim Harold, and so glad to be with you once again. And something that I really enjoy is when we get to speak to folks who not only have their theories about the UFO subject, but they have had experiences as well. And we have two such people on the line today, Leslie and Stephen Shaw. They both have a lifelong love affair with the subject of ufology, and they've been reading and researching it for decades. They call themselves armchair ufologists, but I would say they're just ufologists. They've both been UFO witnesses. Stephen and his extended family have all had missing time incidents and are likely to be UFO abductees. And Leslie has been a journalist for decades, and now she is semi-retired. And Stephen has written content for a website dealing with various health issues and alternative treatments, and very interesting background for both of them. Stephen says he studied geology in college and is a lifelong rock hound. Well, we are going to rock and roll with Leslie and Stephen Shaw. We're so glad to have them on the line. Also, I almost forgot to mention, they have a book out. It's called Who They Are and What They're Up To. And we're talking about whoever or whatever behind those UFOs and UAPs. Leslie and Stephen, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
So on our shows, we talk about personal stories a lot. So how did these experiences start for you, and how did you get into this subject? And I guess maybe ladies first. What about you, Leslie?
Well, Jim, Stephen is the one whose family were experiencing the abduction phenomenon, and he has experiences starting from when he was 3 years old. Go ahead and say, film what happened at age three.
Yeah, when I was three, I was living in Fallbrook, on Fallbrook Avenue in Woodland Hills, California, and I would be commonly awakened by a invisible being jumping on my stomach and my chest, kind of playfully.
Oh my!
A little bit of nothing malevolent. Nothing malevolent. My family came from Great Britain. They grew up in wartime Great Britain as children, and their parents came from Germany and from Scotland. So that area of the world. And I grew up in a family that we were told that we had a family spirit guide that would appear to people at certain times, different times, called O'Glegley. And so I grew up in a spiritual type of family that there were some weird things that would happen to people. And
they were
British, the British being kind of very close-lipped about a lot of things. You know, if you grew up in a British family, you know that the Brits have a different way of dealing with things. So
right, stiff upper lip and all that, right?
Yes, that basically, that kind of, you're very conservative. And I didn't tell my friends at school, in elementary school, that a little being was jumping on my chest. So fast forward to when I was about 10 years old, I was sleeping in the top of a bunk bed. My brother, who was 6 years younger than me, was on the bottom, and I heard this strange sound in the house. It wasn't the dog. I recognized the dog sound, so I got out of bed. This is the middle of the night again, and I'm walking down the hallway, and my heart is pounding, and I'm really nervous. I'm actually scared, so I'm in a very adrenal state, hyper alert, and as I'm about to turn the corner into the living room, I just go blank. And the next thing I remember is I'm back in my bunk bed a few hours later and completely calm.
And Stephen's family, they have dozens and dozens of these kinds of experiences see something weird and then black out.
My brother, who was 6 years younger than me, he, for a couple of years, he slept in the closet in our room. And I say, Philip, why are you sleeping in the closet? He said, well, the little men that come in the night, they scare me.
So,
He would wet his bed a lot too. I think it was out of fear in my brother's case. But I had seen these little men myself once. I have a vague memory of seeing, they look almost like little dwarfs that I saw.
And then one time, Philip, when he was 16 years old, he actually saw a gray alien in his room.
This is a different house. This is a different house.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I want to be very specific that this phenomena has followed me around to at least six different houses.
Yes.
And it's
and
does
followed
it
my family to two different continents. Okay. So
yeah. Does it seem to shape shift? In other words,
no.
It presents itself. Well, So the early thing you saw was not an alien gray, but then you saw alien gray. So you think these are different ones.
No, we believe it's all the same phenomenon. But for a long time, we can't break through Stephen's memory block with hypnosis. We've tried a few times. So, but Philip saw the gray alien in his room before blacking out one time. So that finally let us know what kind of phenomenon we're dealing with here.
Well, the more important thing was what happened to my whole family when I was 18 years old of age. This was January of 1979. This happened over a week's period of time. I was working as a cabinet maker with my dad. Again, a no-nonsense guy. He was a cop. He was a bobby in England for 4 years, and he did military duty. So did I. Okay, anyway. So the first night, my dad came in to my room after... he said, you know, my closet door is open and closed on me, Stephen. So I kind of thought my dad was just like, you know, just imagining something at the time. The second night, my dad came into my room and said, Stephen, I'm hearing the sound of a silver bell inside the wall by the chimney.
Huh.
I said, okay. So I walked into the living room about 9:30 at night. And sure enough, there was a silver bell being rung inside the 2x4 wall.
Huh.
I went to go get my sister.
And she heard it too.
And she was 5 years younger than me. She's about 13 at the time. And she wanted to have nothing to do with this stuff. She was very much, I'm just turning a blind eye to all this weird stuff. And she said, yes, that's a silver bell. And we banged on the wall, looked up the chimney, tried to make some sense of it. And it stayed there for about 15 minutes, and then it went away. Concurrently, the next day, we called my mom and my brother, who were living up in Sonora, California, 335 miles away. This is the house that we were building ourselves as contractors and cabinet makers. We did all the work ourselves. And they were living there. And my brother swears that my mom picked up the phone about 9:30 at night because she heard a ring. And there was a voice. There was a voice on the other end saying something along the lines of, I'm the invisible, I'm beachy. Now, my mom swears that she heard the ring. She picked up the phone. My brother said the phone never rang. This happened the same time we were hearing this silver bell. So that was just odd in and of itself. Now,
Go ahead.
Yeah, the next night, I decided this. I slept in my room, but on the bottom of the bunk bed, and I was awakened by a whizzing sound in the air. And I thought, well, maybe it was like a bug or something like that, so... I looked down the hallway and there's nothing there. So I went back to bed and rolled on my left side. And then from the base of the bed, there were two distinct pushes, like it was being shoved. And again, trying to be logical, saying, well, Southern California, maybe it's a mild earthquake. And so I continued to roll over and tried to go back to sleep. And then it pushed again twice, a little stronger. And then the third time was much stronger. And then I got three distinct taps on my right shoulder, just like somebody with a long index fingers going tap, tap, tap. At this point, I'm both scared and really annoyed. And so I decide, okay, so I rolled over and I went, what? You know, like, and there was nothing there. And then I black out again. And I don't know whether I told my dad, but I just blacked out. Now, the next night, I was afraid to sleep in that room. So I decided to sleep on the couch in the living room. So I went to sleep in my clothes from the day before, you know, and woke up about 5:30 in the morning. It was dark. And I looked at my piano because I'm a musician, lifelong musician. So I thought, well, what am I going to play today? And I listened to the fountain. I was definitely awake and alert. And from behind me, this blue-white entity about 6 to 7 feet tall came gliding, walking toward me in about a second to 2 seconds and stopped by my right side. The whole room was filled up with this blue, white, intense light. I mean, the whole room.
Yeah.
Okay. And it stopped by my right side And the whole right side of my body, just like always bisected down the center, was I couldn't move a thing. I still have feeling on my left side, but I could not move a thing on my right side. And I thought, oh God, this is the spirit guide, old Glegley. I'm going to actually see the family spirit guide. But part of me was really scared because I couldn't, I was immobilized. So the being, the entity, bent down toward my right ear and said in my right ear, not inside my head, but in my right ear, said, and it was, I couldn't tell whether it was male or female, but it was
and
like
I didn't catch that. Did he say Steven?
It whispered, hi, Steve.
Hi, Steve.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't catch
said
that.
My name.
It was in his ear.
So yes. We're not going to have time to go into the great detail of every single experience just because we don't have much time. But
okay,
this
the,
essentially,
the important thing
yeah,
about
finish
this
out
one.
This one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The important thing about this one was that 6 hours later, I was going to get some food for my dad and I pulled out the coins that were in my right side pocket and I put them on the counter and all the coins were magnetized.
Huh.
This is 6 hours later. I could pick up the coins with the coins, the nails with the coins. It didn't matter. And my dad and I said, well, that's not possible.
Yeah, and, specifically designed not to be magnetized
right.
so they can
so,
go in cigarette machines.
Sure.
That was absolute physical. It was physical evidence that I was contacted directly by some force, some being.
Now, let me ask you, so these episodes continued throughout your growing up years and beyond?
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. He's still having issues with the beings invading his wakeful state and also his sleeping state and his astral state.
They presented myself they've also presented themselves to my mom and then to her mother and different people in the family. You know, generationally, this was a generational thing.
I think it's multiple generations.
Right.
So they were taking his parents, and this is typical of the abduction phenomenon. They find a strain of DNA that they like, that they want to take more of, and they keep taking that person again and again and again through their lives. And then they'll begin taking their children and their grandchildren, and just tends to grow conically in a graph form and within families
and
communities.
Go ahead.
Sorry, you go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and these are included in the book. Many of these experiences, who are they and what they're up to? Those experiences, many of them are included in there.
Yes, they're in the intro.
Okay. Yes, we just start with our experiences as our reason for writing the book. But since it's the book is really more about answering the big questions like who they are and what they want and what they're up to, we just kind of. It was a short
sure. Well, let me
chapter on our experiences.
Leslie, it doesn't sound like your experiences have been quite as intense or as long lasting.
That's correct. I saw my first UFO though in 2005 with mm-hmm. Stephen,
mm-hmm.
and you know, before that, I believed what he was telling me. It's just I only believed it maybe 98%, and then you see your first UFO, and now I'm 100% believer, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw a second one together too. And our first one together was a white light in the sky, but it took off and was gone over the northern horizon in about a quarter of a second. If I were going to estimate its speed, it would have been 20,000 miles an hour, maybe just way, way past anything we have the capability of recreating.
Right. Now, okay, so let's get to the theories. Stephen has had this lifetime of experiences, even stretching back to his ancestors and his family.
Yes.
You've had some sightings in relatively recent years. So
yes.
You decide to write this book. Give us kind of a brief overview of how you approach the book.
Well, years ago, we heard, this is about 30 years ago, we heard about nanodiamonds discovered in 13,000-year-old soil in far North America, which indicated that the extinction event of 13,000 years ago that wiped out the Clovis people and the mammoth and the mastodon and the dire wolf and the saber-toothed cat and the American horse and camel, a lot of other animals too. It was like a mini extinction event. And the nanodiamonds proved that it was a celestial impact of some kind.
Hmm.
But nobody could find the crater. And so, well, everyone's like, well, where's the crater? And then sure enough, it was discovered in 2016 under the Hiawatha Glacier in northern Greenland. So it's called the Hiawatha Asteroid Impact Crater. And it would have caused 2,000-foot-high tsunamis worldwide. And we believed it to be the cause of the all the many, many flood myths in our most ancient war. Mm-hmm. Of course, we all know about Noah, but when the flood myths were starting to be researched worldwide, they discovered that there were around 1,200 separate cultures that have an ancient flood myth.
That's my point about the flood myth, is that I'm not sure how much of a myth it is in terms
it's
of not being...
It's not a myth anymore,
exactly,
we now know.
Because you have all these disparate cultures, religions, peoples who all reference it. So something definitely happened.
And it definitely did. The asteroid was big enough to fit within Washington, D.C. The crater is big enough. And so it was a large event and would have caused 2,000-foot high tsunamis worldwide rushing to the coasts at, you know, hundreds of miles an hour, and would have been quite devastating. And that's, you know, one of the reasons human history rarely precedes 13,000 years ago. We know almost nothing about our past prior to that. And, you know, the human race has been, Homo sapiens sapiens has been on this planet for at least 120,000 years. And mainstream archaeology would have had us believe that we sat around for 107,000 years without making any advancements until 13,000 years ago. We just decided to get smart and start building things and inventing things. But we know the human race is not like that at all. We're not likely to sit around stagnant for 107,000 years. So we propose that the human race was rather advanced when Hiawatha hit. And we think it's kind of like a deep impact scenario where they decided to warn everybody all around the world, either build an ark or go to high ground or dig in underground. And we think a large portion of people dug in underground to survive the, and also escaped into space and to survive the disaster. And those people is, that's where we divide in two. The human race divides in two. The people that forget their technology because they're living on the surface and were almost wiped out, or the people that kept their technology.
So pre-flood.
And are
so,
at least 13,000 years ahead of us.
So pre-flood, you believe that humanity had the capability of space travel.
We think they
One thing that's a real big tell is that all these flood myths, there was forewarning. People mm-hmm. were giving forewarning, including Noah, you know, who was the son sure. of Lamech, and his granddad was Enoch. You know, they all lived about 900 to 1,000 years. So they were all given forewarning. So guess what?
They had
somebody, either us or somebody, had advanced astronomy, and they either couldn't do something about it, didn't have the technology to both stop the impact, or they didn't want to. So, but there was forewarning in all cases.
Yeah.
Okay. So it wasn't something that just blindsided us.
Right.
You didn't actually find that there was a genetic bottleneck in the human genome that,
yes.
but that we know that about 13,000 years ago, that the human race on the surface was reduced to about 10,000 individuals. So we, 8 billion right now, have regenerated from a fairly less diverse genetic genome is, you know, so, you know, perhaps a lot of us being psychic was just a normal thing.
Mm-hmm.
Certain abilities that we had, we have lost, or they have been greatly reduced.
For instance, telepathy, the Greys always, well, aliens always communicate with their abductees telepathically.
Mostly.
And we think that this is because it's a human trait. And for instance, when you do kundalini raising exercises, chanting, meditation, you start to become more telepathic. And we believe that this is a human trait that has atrophied in us, but has not atrophied in them, because they continue the practices of keeping it open.
So,
day one.
Let me understand this. So before there was a bifurcation, there were... The humans had stayed on the surface. Then there were humans who possibly went on to space. So the ancient aliens, or ancient astronauts, as von Däniken put it, were the ancient astronauts essentially us?
That's what we think in this, at least in the 13,000 years ago scenario, we think it was humans that separated from us and went underground. When I look at a gray alien, what I see is a human being that's been underground for 13,000 years. Their eyes are larger. They're paler. They
don't need as much hair.
They don't require hair anymore.
They're smaller.
require protection. And have you ever heard of the hair of the alien, where a man in Australia was visited by women? One of them looked like a hybrid human, like she was she had white hair, big eyes, pointy chin, pointy cheekbones. After they left, and the next morning he woke up, there was a long blonde hair in his bed, and he took it to be analyzed, and it was a human hair, but unlike human hair too, because it was clear, like fishing line, and that is not a typical human trait. And also it had bizarre DNA. It had Gaelic and Basque. And we know that Basques are a race of people that are disproportionately taken by the abduction phenomenon.
And the highest percentage of A negative blood, negative.
Yes, on the planet. Rh negative. They also prefer Rh negative. And Basque people happen to have a high percentage of Rh negative blood.
The highest on the planet.
So this is still a human, but a human like nobody else has ever, that certainly we don't acknowledge as a real race on our planet. But we think that they're, and we've heard thousands of reports of testimony where people see UFOs coming up out of the ocean, up out of lakes, up out of volcanoes, out of the sides of mountains, out of the sides of mesas and ridges, like they have deep underground bases and they're launching their UFOs from there. And we think that's also why they're so worried about our nuclear program. And I think that's because they have skin in the game as well. Like, you know, an alien race from a far distant solar system wouldn't care that much if we destroyed ourselves. They wouldn't care so much that they would dog our military every single time we go out on maneuvers. They're following our military.
That's one thing we found out during the summer.
The hearings.
The hearings this summer. That's a Fravor and Grush. And Graves are all saying that, listen, every time we go out on missions, whether they be submarines or they be aircraft carrier fleets, these UFOs are following us. And in fact, that they're only being reported about 5 to 10% of the time, because there's this basically, non-disclosure type of, we don't talk about this stuff, it'll risk your career. So,
right. So they're seeing 10,000 times per year.
Reported. Well,
and that's reported sightings.
Well, that's
worldwide.
The thing, the unidentified submerged objects, the ones that go under the water, and the transmedium that go from underwater to up in the sky. And it does, with some of the David Grush things and so forth, they talk about non-human intelligences. And there's been a little more thought that maybe whatever this is not necessarily all of it from out there, but it's from somewhere here.
In here, yeah.
Well, we both know just how we're tinkering around now with the human genome and CRISPR technology, and we're just in the infancy stage. Give human beings an extra 10 to 13,000 years, and genetics becomes like tinker toys.
Well, one thing that I've always noticed, and I'm maybe a little bit younger than you guys, but I'm certainly not a kid. I'm in my 50s, and when I grew up, there was one telephone in the house. It was one of those old Western Electric black telephones that hang on the kitchen wall, and that was
it. That's what we had.
That's what you had. Now I have I just picked it up off the charger. I have an iPhone 15 Pro Max, and I can communicate with anybody in the world. I can look up, the world's recorded information. I can even talk to AI and get answers. Now, how do we go from the Western Electric wall telephone in a mere 50 years to what I have in my hand? I think
right.
We had some help.
We think it is the
yes,
the,
we have.
It's the Intel chips, the microprocessing chips. That is supposed to be reverse engineered from alien technology.
Yeah, we went from vacuum tubes and televisions then to
integrated circuitry. Circuits. Yeah,
right, exactly. So in a very short period of time, and fiber optics and Velcro and other different drips and drabs that have really jump started where we are. I mean, we have gone. If you look back, even if you look back at human being just a few hundred years ago, when Leslie was in England, she was. Going through some of the castles and the armor, these people were significantly shorter.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
4 foot tall.
Yeah, and then the doorways significantly shorter. So it's,
we've changed a lot physically and I believe it.
Oh, genetically, well. we have changed about 7% in the past 3,000 years.
Yes, and that's an enormous leap.
Right.
That would take usually 50,000 years for that kind of modification.
Very short period of time.
And so then we think they're modifying our race as they go.
And our brains too, of course.
And we think the hybrid breeding program is an effort to reintegrate with us or possibly to infiltrate and get what they want, which is denuclearization.
Why do you think we're seeing this big, I mean, even as we speak today on January 25th, this week, there's been a lot of back and forth and people coming out saying this is all a bunch of hokum, other people coming out and saying, no, you're wrong. A lot of finger pointing, a lot of infighting, but a lot of activity around the UFO subject in the last few years, particularly last year. Why do you think that is?
Well, there's a generalized policy of basically make fun of, ridicule,
sure,
threaten, and then consequences. You know, there's this thing, you know, you look at the timing during World War II.
Well,
Foo Fighters started showing up.
Yeah,
on all sides were seeing them to start with.
And then they had the after the weapons were used, the nuclear weapons, that's when they made efforts to contact our leaders. There was the flyover happened in 1952 where they buzzed the Capitol. And that got their attention, and they finally set up a meeting with Eisenhower. I'm not sure how, but that's when it happened.
Oh, yeah, Valiant Thorce showed up in a field in Richmond, Virginia, and said, you know, basically take me to your leader.
That's another one.
Yeah.
Have you heard of that? Valiant Thor landed a spaceship in a field in Virginia?
Yes.
Well, that's another one. Guess what he looked like? He was a Caucasian red-haired man, you know?
White,
so
pale.
So we think he's a Nordic. Or possibly a hybrid that they've bred specifically to communicate with us.
And there's the famous firefight over Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah,
in 1942.
I think, yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
we think
exactly.
That was another effort to contact us.
A lot of people saw that, and it wasn't mass hysteria. So, and then of course you go back to 1938 with War of the Worlds. You know, that showed that we're pretty xenophobic.
But
yeah.
The recent change in the disclosure policy we talk about in Chapter 2. What happened was Luis Elizondo, who was head of ATIP, which was the UFO investigation department at the time, he left the organization with three videos that he released to the New York Times, the Go Fast, the Gimbal, and the Tic Tac videos.
Mm-hmm.
And right after that, we expected the usual response from the government. This is not real. This is fake. It's swamp gas. It's... You're seeing things, it's mass hysteria. But instead, they came out and all our jaws in the ufology community dropped when they said, these things are real. It's a real phenomenon. And then they said, but we don't know what it is. And they released the videos in their entirety to the world that point.
It was the golly gee, we don't know what they are, but they are here. So
yeah, but we know that they're still lying because we know that.
Well, somebody's lying. I mean,
they have crashed spaceships.
Was it Sean Kirkpatrick that just came out and said, well, you know, a lot of this is advanced military technology and there's not a hint of extraterrestrials? I mean, I don't know.
Fravor himself.
Yeah, something is
countered that.
Yeah,
I can counteract that easily.
He said it was an order of magnitude of technology.
I can counteract that easily.
Go ahead.
Okay, just real quick. I know we're on a time crunch. Okay, there have been bits and pieces have been found from the Roswell crash, mm-hmm. which of course was 1947, which have been analyzed on the most recent high tech electron microscopes, and these pieces. They are layered in micron size. A human hair is 67 microns thick. Okay, that's a human hair. Okay, the outer shield of the crashed spacecraft is made of almost completely pure zinc and magnesium welded together, 200 to 400 microns in size. The center one is bismuth, which is only 2 microns. Again, human hair is 67 microns. Then the inner surface is absolutely pure aluminum that we don't have, with nanoparticles of iridium, which only comes from asteroids. So these things are layered technology that was made back in 1947, at least. We do not have the technology to do that right now.
Not even today.
Physical proof that this is not, oh, well, you know, it's just advanced stuff they're not telling us. That is such crap.
Then actually, in a report they released, the DOD released, they're saying this is not technology from Russia or China. this is an order of magnitude beyond our current
physics. It's nanotechnology we're dealing with here, basically.
They're able to negate gravity, and they're able to take off at 20,000 miles an hour at speed without getting smushed against the wall
or breaking the equipment inside the vehicles.
Yeah, at that speed, even the equipment would be crushed.
Wouldn't last.
So they have definitely, and Fravor at the hearings was saying, no, this is not human technology. This is very advanced. He did this, the one that said it's another magnitude of technology, another level entirely.
One thing that I want to inject real quick. You ever hear about Robert Bigelow and Bigelow Aircraft?
Yes.
I think that's okay. All right. So he's not required of the Freedom of Information Act because he's in the private sector. He was the prior owner of Skinwalker Ranch.
Mm-hmm.
And he's famously quoted as saying, the aliens that we're looking for are right under our noses.
Okay. Or right under our feet.
Right under our feet. Right under our noses. Okay.
Yeah, we have the exact quote.
And he has not released any of the stuff that they found in the 10 or 12 years that they were researching the stuff. But so, you know, again, it lends credence. Even the American Indians talk about the Anunnaki, the space brothers that saved them, took them underground. They you know, the American Indians have a totally different viewpoint. They call them star brothers, star friends, mm-hmm. and people. And they have just been seeing it for thousands of years, and they're not as xenophobic as, you know, as we are.
And I'd like to point out that the gray alien, even though it's quite different than us, it's still the closest thing we have to a relative on this planet. There's no, the closest other being to
genetically
us
speaking,
is the bonobo chimp. And we know their skeletal structure is entirely different. They don't stand perfectly upright. They still run on all fours when frightened and take to the trees. And we're talking about no frontal lobe whatsoever.
And they don't have a neocortex.
Yeah. Whereas the gray aliens, they're much more like us than we are to our closest relative.
At a distance, they look like 10-year-old children.
Yes. In fact, one of the sightings we quote in the book was from a police sergeant who's saw them walking around their spaceship before they saw him, and they jumped back in their spaceship and took off. And he described them as either very large children or very small adults.
Yeah, and this is 1964, Sephora, Mexico.
Yeah. And, you know, if they're moving
Lonnie
like
Zamora,
us,
right?
That means their musculature is like us, too.
Pardon? What was that?
Lonnie Zamora?
Lonnie Zamora.
The Zamora
side. So do you think the truth will out? Do you think, because it seems like to me what I'm seeing, and this is just from looking outside, is that, you know, some very powerful things have happened the last few years, particularly last year, in getting some information out, getting at least some disclosure. And it seems like to me that the powers that be who are anti-disclosure have really come back in full force, and they're trying to totally put an end to this. They're coming out
they're
and
trying
saying
to
these
punish,
people,
Grush, you know,
these people are crazy. These people are crazy. This is a religion. That's what it looks like to me. Do you think the forces for disclosure will win out, or do you think, as has been the case post-World War II, that the forces who don't want to see any disclosure will win out? What do you think?
That's the $64,000 question. The British have been starting to release information from their files, and we know with the Freedom of Information Act, more stuff is coming forward. But if you look at just necessity, what would happen to world religions? What would happen to world stock markets, economies, and such? If it were said, yes, the aliens are real, or saying that, you know, oh no, we're advanced humans have been living in cities under the ground, and we've known about this, and we've been working with them, and they are here, and they really are the top dogs.
And they're permitting the abduction phenomenon to continue.
Yeah, the cow mutilations, the abduction, the stealing of our genetics. Which, by the way, if you look at the vampire mythos and the alien abductions, they're almost exactly the same.
Yeah, they come in the
almost
night.
Almost exactly the same.
They're very pale. They can paralyze you, and then they take DNA in the form of blood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
And an incubus. I'm sorry.
No, go. That would make sense with a hybrid program, right?
Right, yeah. Exactly.
So,
the incubus would be more like that.
So, you know, there's going to be pushback, and whether there's going to be any full disclosure at any time point in any time soon, I would doubt that myself, because
they would have to admit they've been in league with them all these years.
Yeah, exactly.
Fascinating. There's a lot of theories. We've just scratched the surface with Leslie and Stephen Shaw. The book is Who Are They and What They're Up To. Leslie and Stephen, where can people find the book and more information about your research?
It's on Amazon and on Ingram.
It's Who They Are, by the way.
Who They Are and What They're Up To by Leslie and Stephen Shaw. In Leslie first, because I did the majority of the writing. I'm the journalist in the family. But Stephen, of course, wrote his entire family's part. And then it's also, we do have a website at whotheyarebook.com. And I'm setting up an Instagram page at the top now where we're trying to post real life things that people are sharing with us. We're just getting started with that. But they can find us at leslie.shaw.author. And we'd be happy to hear from any of your listeners if they would like to tell their story to us. We'd be thrilled. And our Facebook is the same handle, leslie.shaw.author.
Is it leslie.book.author?
Leslie.shaw.author is okay. The Instagram, dear.
Okay.
There you go. I tell you, it is hard to keep up with all of those social media handles for sure. The book is Who They Are and What They're Up To. I want to make sure I get that right this time. Who They Are and What They're Up To. Our guests today have been Leslie Shaw and Stephen Shaw. Thank you both. And Stephen, I noticed that you were a veteran for several years of the U.S. Navy, so thank you for your service to the country.
6 years, yes. I've worn the blue hats and the white hats throughout my life.
So. And he was an acupuncturist.
State licensed acupuncturist and Tai Chi teacher.
He's tired now, but yeah.
I've done a lot of things.
A renaissance man, indeed. Well, yes. Again, thank you both for being on the show.
Thanks so much, Jim.
And thank you for tuning into the program. I appreciate it. And we'll talk to you next time. And keep your eyes to the skies and maybe under the water, too. Bye-bye, everybody.